Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
Hello, you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald.
It has been a year since the Labour government walked into a huge majority in the Commons after over a decade in opposition. We're going to reflect on that victory. Was it hollow? The introduction of reform, the collapse of the Conservative Party, and we'll look back at the top four issues facing the country and whether Labour has done a good enough job. But before we do that, let's get to the election.
A seismic shift took place tonight on the British political landscape. 14 years of Tory rule came to an end.
The Labour Party has won this general election, and I have called Sir Keir Starmer to congratulate him on his victory.
Across our country, people will be waking up to the news, relieved that a weight has been lifted, a burden finally removed from the shoulders of this great nation. And now we can look forward again.
So one year ago tomorrow, I've said that right? The first Labour government was elected in my adult lifetime. And we're going to look back into that election victory first. Joining us in the studio is John Elledge, columnist, author. You can see his work in The New Statesman, in The New World. But most significantly, he's Zoe's mum's favourite columnist, journalist. John, it's thank you so much for joining us today.
Hello, and hello to Zoe's mum. Very nice to be here.
Nice shout out for Zoe's mum. Guys, let's look back on the Labour victory. Are you just hearing Rishi Sunak's voice was a little bit triggered. I forgot he existed. Mm. Wherever you are, thoughts and prayers with you, Rishi.
California, one assumes. Mm.
So it's hard now thinking back because so much has gone wrong, so much has gone right. A year is a long time in politics. But let's talk about how significant that victory was, first of all. I mean, largely we all expected it because of how the campaign went and where the polls were. But John, talk to us a little bit about that Labour victory and its significance.
I mean, it's significant insofar as we had 14 years of Tory-led government. And, you know, in my entire lifetime, and I'm getting on a bit now, in my entire lifetime, we've only changed the party of the Prime Minister three times. That it doesn't happen very often. So it's significant in that sense. It's significant in that Labour has very rarely won with a decent majority. I think Starmer is the only Labour Prime Minister other than Attlee and Blair to come in with a three-figure majority, so that's significant. It is proving rather less significant in terms of the whether the government is delivering on the change narrative that I think in some ways they tried quite hard not to promise too much. If there was a single line they were pushing in the election, it was like, you know, trying to lower the electorate's expectations. But nonetheless, I think the electorate were hoping for a change election. And so there has inevitably been disappointment with the pace of change and quite how slow it's been and quite how the extent to which the constraints that existed before that election turn out not just to have been about who was in government, but in terms of the state of the public finances, the attitudes of the bond market, the international situation. So Starmer has faced a lot of the same constraints that Rishi Sunak faced before him. On the other side of the ledger, though, one way in which he doesn't have any constraints is he has his own mandate. He did come in with this massive majority. Yeah. He could be fairly confident that he could run for a five-year term without any bother at all. And I don't feel, I don't know how you guys feel, I don't feel he's kind of taken full advantage of the freedom that that does bring under the British political system. Well, like, if you come in with a big majority, for the next 5 years, you can kind of do what you want to a certain extent.
Yeah, so in the way that I guess Theresa May, certainly after 2017, didn't have a majority and had to be really careful, I guess one of the things 411, was it, MPs gives you, is that big majority. Zoe, reflect on the election victory.
Well, I think the thing we're going to keep coming back to in this episode is that there was just a fundamental misreading from Labour, potentially some commentators, potentially myself, about what it was the country wanted. There was this feeling that because the Tories had been so chaotic, people were just sick to the back teeth of politicians and, you know, the various things they do. And people just wanted to feel secure and better off. So that might be more money in their pocket. But it also meant a slightly sort of lighter touch government that just wasn't constantly making headlines and would just get on with fixing things and leave people alone. Now, yes, that sounds great, but actually, whether it was the depth of the despairs that the country was in or whether it was just not actually what people wanted, there was far more anger, I think, than we really understood. And what people really want, and you can see now, is radical change. And I'm sure we'll get onto the rise of Reform, the complete rejection of the Conservative Party. Labour were brought in with a bit of hesitation and a sigh, not because people were really enthusiastic about what, as John said, what Labour was offering. They weren't really offering anything substantial. I mean, I'm trying to think, what was the flagship promise?
Well, it was that old. I'm not with him.
Yeah,
t-shirt.
It basically was.
We're not them. Yeah,
and you know, I was trying to think. I swear that at one point, Labour's thing was get Britain building again, which sounded like it could be quite a big vision. But then it kind of died again, and then it was just sort of we're not the Tories, and then that kind of faded away. And what was left was a government that basically was still presiding over managed decline. And I think people just did not have the patience to see whether that would work. It was quite clear it wasn't going to work, and it wasn't going to satiate voters.
I guess one thing I'll say is actually where Labour did do quite well in the election, because they were so far ahead in the polls, and we were so far ahead in the polls, the strategy was do no harm. Like, make polling day as close to the day that the election was called, because there were so, and that was done quite well. I guess there were very few screw ups. It was a fairly competent campaign,
but it was theirs to lose, wasn't it?
But what's,
and
what's,
they did, their vote share dropped. Over
well, that's
the
and that's what I want to talk about, because ultimately, 411 MPs, huge majority, first Labour Prime Minister since 2010. Those are all the main headlines. But when we dig down, and I think Sir John Curtis on election night started to do it, and people weren't ready for it at that time. I think there was a lot of heat back as to why he's sort of shitting on the parade of Labour on election night. But I remember Sir John Curtis on election night was saying, everybody just take a step back. This isn't a huge supermajority in the votes on the ground. This is a result of the first-past-the-post system. So Labour got, over 411 MPs, but it, because some have since had the whip withdrawn and others, the number is a bit scarcer now. But that was on 34.7% of the vote, round up to 35% of the vote. And they got 62% of the House of Commons seats with 35% of the votes. John, that's not a stomping mandate from the people.
Absolutely not. It was a lower share of the vote than they got certainly in 2017.
And less raw votes than Corbyn got in 2019.
I think it might be. I think I'm fairly sure it's a lower share of the vote than they got in 2010, possibly. I mean, partly that's about fragmentation in electoral behaviour. We have a lot more parties drawing significant number of votes than there were. But partly I do think it is that the Ming vase strategy that he called it, you know, just don't drop the vase.
Yeah.
Got to get it across this polished floor. Just like be very, very, very careful. And between that and also, frankly, I think Starmer's personality, they've been scared to kind of like offer a vision of what a Labour country was going to look like. So it was a weird election night. I do remember, I am old enough to remember election night 97. I wasn't old enough to vote, but I was watching. Yeah. And that felt very different. There was excitement. Like the story was like, this is change. Everything is going to change. Even on election night last year, the BBC especially was saying, well, the story of tonight is the Reform surge. As if we weren't watching a Labour landslide happen. And in terms of, we can talk about the vote share and so on and the lack of enthusiasm. But nonetheless, Labour won 174 seat majority. That is, in terms of the way our system works, that is a landslide.
Yeah,
that
but
surely
I guess,
should have been the story of the night.
I guess my question would be to both of you, what we've seen since, so where Labour are in the polls now, right, is that not unsurprising, given that, yes, they got a huge landslide, but it didn't come with a huge amount of enthusiasm within that voter base, or even a massive voter base to begin with, and 34.7%. isn't naturally what you would get with 60% of power in the chamber. So is it not natural that they sit, well, Labour sits, what, between 22 and 30% right now, somewhere in that region.
I think so, but I think there was a feeling, there was a hope amongst some voters that Labour was carrying this Ming vase, and they were very public about the fact that they were carrying this Ming vase. I mean, I interviewed several quite high-profile politicians who would say on record, we're carrying a Ming vase across the floor, which was almost like a bit of a wink and a nudge, like, but don't worry, because once we're in, we don't have to carry that Ming vase anymore. We can be a bit, you know, we can throw things around. But they haven't. So I think there was almost a feeling amongst some voters that, they're just pretending that they're not going to do
we
radical things,
that,
but they might
that.
Do it.
We had that a lot on this show, didn't we, where people were saying he'll be much more
radical.
Radical's not the Keir Starmer's a lot of things, not radical. But he'll be a lot
consequential.
More. Yeah, he'll be unchained once he's actually in office, which doesn't prove the case.
Well, I do think there are major changes. There are ways in which things are changing a lot. They're looking a lot more to future investment. The planning stuff is quite significant. They are investing in sort of long-term economic measures in terms of capital spending and so on. But it feels like they have nothing. They've got a time horizon of 10 years and they've got a time horizon of 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And there's nothing in between.
Yeah, and lastly, I want to talk about, because we're going to actually get to that, the stuff that's happened, and I want us all to give a scorecard, which will be the introduction of reform. Now, I had always been in my political lifetime been told, you know, we're a 2-3 party system at best in this country, new parties don't work, look at what happened to SDP, look at what happened with all UKIP collapse. But reform have not only took 4 MPs, they took millions of votes, and now are sort of establishment potential future government. Talk to us about the introduction of reform. Zoe, you go first.
Well, I always feel a bit sorry for the Lib Dems because they're always there and everyone always ignores them. But then Nigel Farage comes along and obviously gets way more attention. The Lib Dems had the best election result ever.
72.
Most seats in the land. Yeah. 72.
But, you know, they're kind of resigned to that, whereas everybody loves a challenger party. And, of course, Reform are riding high off the fact that the Tories were so badly bruised from every direction. I mean, there isn't a single Tory voter I can think of, unless you just are born a Tory voter and put your fingers in your ears when anyone says anything bad about Boris Johnson, who would still want to vote Conservative with Reform being there, with Labour shifting to the centre, with the Lib Dems picking up votes, and with everything that happened over the last 5 years specifically. So,
and every poll, by the way, today would say if the election was held today, Nigel Farage would be Prime Minister. Every single poll.
Yeah.
Well, no, hang on. I'm not sure that's true. The polls do suggest they would be the largest party.
They would have to form a government.
They would have to be a majority. So, I mean, in practice, it probably would be Farage.
But you're right. They'd be the largest party. Whether they're able to form a government with the other parties, some MRP polls say they would have a majority, but most would actually put them in a hung parliament.
Also, in the event of an election, I do think there will be kind of consolidation of the anti-reform
parties. That's what Labour's hoping. Okay, listen, we're going to get back to this after the break. After the break, we're going to talk about scorecards. So we're going to look at economy and welfare, NHS, crime and immigration, foreign policy, and housing. And we're each going to give Labour a scorecard for what they've done and how they've done in the first year. That'll be after this break.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on FUPAR Radio.
We've got, like,
Pulse of the Nation with Andrew White on FUPAR Radio.
Danny Harmer, hello.
Thank you, what an introduction.
I heard in an interview, this may no longer be the case, but in 2020 you said you'd never actually read the original Tracy Beaker.
I've still never read it, and I'm gonna go down with this ship, and quite frankly, I shall never read it. I've got this far in life. And do you know what? I think it's kind of, in a weird way, I think it helped me get the part, because I had no idea of this character apart from the character that I made her.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores. Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
I was fine on this beach the other day. I didn't know the time of high tide changes, and I had no idea it could come in so fast. So I'm finding out the hard way. From this fella, the Coast Guard, who dropped in to get me out.
Ready!
Before you go to the coast, check the tide times online. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses.
But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees, so don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search, don't get caught out.
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
You might then see friends, family that require a little bit of support, financial advice. How do you go about sharing that advice, sharing that support without being condescending?
A practical tip that everyone can do that is low friction, send them financial content that you like. If you have a favorite content creator, if you see an article that you like, send them the video and just ask them, what do you think? And then that can begin a conversation around it.
What the Hell with Georges Bertineau on FUBAR Radio.
I'm joined by Alex Mitten, retreat host and mentor.
I think a lot of people are lonely, surrounded by people at the minute. Like, you know, especially living in London, there's fucking people everywhere. But we sort of live these quite strange lives now where we're quite closed down emotionally, you know, even just like with our voice. We don't really speak that often sometimes, do you know what I mean?
Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald.
We've got John Elledge in the studio today, our columnist and author, and we're talking about 1 year with the Labour government. And for the next section, we're doing things a little bit different this week. We're going to do our scorecards, a little bit like the NRA. In America. We're going to look back at some of the key issues that the government has attempted to tackle and see how they've done. We're going to do it with a caveat of it's been a year. Obviously, they had a difficult handover for sure. And so we're not expecting them to get everything right. But in the context of the year, how they've done. Let's start with the economy and welfare we'll include in that as well. So just to give our panellists some quick numbers. So inflation sits about 3.4%, which is well down on how bad it was during the middle of Rishi's term for sure. But it is up in year by about 0.2%, I think. So it currently sits at 3.4%. Unemployment is at 4.6%, which is also increased. House prices are up by 3.5% as of April 2025. And which we talk about, John, I know you've got a lot to say. That's got its own section at the end of the programme. So the numbers don't look great overall in terms of if that's how you measure the economy through CPI and employment and other things. But we've also seen a government that's sort of rigorously committed to Rachel Reeves's fiscal rules, which have come under heavy criticism, and growth. Their main message, certainly for the first 6 months, was growth is what this government was going to be measured in, and that hasn't really come yet. So in terms of handling of the economy overall, how do we think they've done? John?
I mean, they are dealing with a very difficult international situation. Obviously, energy prices are up. Trump sneezes and the world's markets catch a cold. You know, so like the guy posts something on Truth Social and suddenly bond markets.
And his friends get rich.
Yeah. Do you know what it is? I was going to say bond markets have a shit fit.
He's got to be the only leader, by the way, who's actually tweeted. Because if you look at the way he's tweeting and the lack of punctuations, it's definitely him.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think it is difficult out there. But nonetheless, I think Labour have made some significant mistakes. I think they probably should have been bolder about just going, well, Jeremy Hunt's tax cuts were politically motivated and unsustainable. We're going to have to reverse them, judge us on it in 5 years. I think they should have been bolder there. And also, if they'd done that, then maybe they wouldn't have had to put up employers' NI contributions, which I think probably is actually one of the things that's kind of pushing down on growth and wages.
Yeah, and they went heavy on the fiscal rules, didn't they? And it looks like in November she might have to scrap them, Zoe, no?
Yeah, I mean, it looks like a lot of things could happen then. I mean, there's also, you know, this any savings that Rachel Reeves tries to find are either wiped out by her backbenchers or by Donald Trump, as John said. So there is this shuffling around for money. and this suggestion of tax rises. But they're never the right tax rises. I mean, they made these kind of ironclad pledges in their manifesto, didn't they? They weren't going to hike, They weren't going to hike income tax, national insurance or VAT?
Yes.
Yes. And, of course, they did hike national insurance, but only for employers, as if employers don't pass those costs down to consumers and employees. The problem for me is there is some interesting stuff that Labour have done to try and stimulate the economy. You know, they have this infrastructure... this 10-year industrial strategy that was published quite recently, and that has some like pretty forward-facing stuff. They've got £100 billion of additional public capital investment. They are trying to get the economy moving. We'll talk about planning, and I'm sure in another section, but you know that's important as well. There are long-term actions they're taking to try and get more investment in the country and get things moving again, which I think is good. But it is just the case that tinkering at the edges, when there are so many factors beyond your control happening internationally, whether that be conflict or Donald Trump or whatever, just is not going to produce anything that is and goes anywhere near the level of change we need. And actually, there are things they could be doing to the tax system that would help. So you think about council tax reform, for example. There's also, as you said, changing the fiscal rules. There's also, you know, we keep saying it, but wealth taxes. You could look at a way of trying to generate some money from the really rich people. You could talk about equalising capital gains tax. I mean, there are mechanisms at their disposal, but they're so scared.
So can I interrupt? Sorry, because I want to ask both of you this. What you're saying is being said by progressive commentators, I would say, people on the centre-left, the PLP is screaming it now in Westminster for that sort of agenda. But the government is still resisting. Starmer and Rachel Reeves and others. Why are they still resisting? Why do we think that is? Either one.
I mean, on the matter of wealth taxes, I really want wealth taxes to work because, you know, I do think there are a lot of people who have a lot of capital at this point. The problem you run into, I think, is that a lot of that is locked up in the housing market. Mm-hmm. And if you try and tax housing wealth, even though we probably do need to do that, you are probably signing your own death warrant in the next election. That is the reason they are being, and the same reason they're kind of not looking at council tax reform, which we desperately need. We're still using 1991 valuations.
Yeah.
It is insane that you are paying, relative to wages, you are paying much higher council taxes in Hartlepool than you are in London. That is insane. But the problem is it's very difficult to kind of change that without really annoying one set of voters who don't want to vote for you again without anyone else being pleased enough to kind of then vote for you instead.
Yeah.
It's that's the problem.
It's, but it's like, also we know how to solve the problem.
We don't know how to do it without losing the next election.
But capital gains tax could be increased by 1% and that would raise billions of pounds, hopefully, if they paid it. And that would still put us below places like Germany and France and America and other things. But there just seems to be... even though there's a sort of cry from within the PLP, there's a refusal to do it and a resistance to do it. And I actually want to bring in welfare now because we don't have a lot of time. I'm having to bunch up a lot of these things. But where the Labour government has found significant resistance from its own party is in the economy and welfare space, mostly. Foreign policy as well, but we get to that. So the two-child limit and the resistance to undo the two-child policy limit has received a huge amount of backlash, including members of the Labour Party having the whip withdrawn from them. The winter fuel cuts, which then had to be U-turned after the local elections, received quite a significant amount of backlash. And then the welfare bill, which was an absolute debacle, whereby they had to essentially scrap the whole thing an hour before it went to a vote. Has all of this eroded Starmer's authority significantly just 1 year in, Zoe?
I mean, you have to ask why people would be in the Labour Party, and they'll probably tell you they want a government that wraps its arms around people who are poor and lifts them out of poverty. Yeah. And when you're saying that you will not remove the two-child benefit cap and you're going to take... that you're going to take benefits that are not out of work benefits, you know, PIP isn't an out of work benefit, away from disabled people who are already struggling with the cost of living and the disability employment payment gap. It's very, very hard to see how those are Labour values. And so you've got people who voted Labour saying, that's not really what I voted for. You've got MPs saying, that's not really what I came into the Labour Party for. And when you break it down and figure out why they're doing it, again, it goes back to this constantly wanting to tinker at the edges, find savings rather than doing anything radical. And John's probably right. There are that, you know, it is political suicide. Just look at what happened when they tried to change the winter fuel allowance. If you have a group of very influential voters, which pensioners are, they're the largest voting bloc, you're going to, you know, it's career suicide.
We've spoken about, and John, I'll get your reaction to this. We've spoken about the politics of all this as well. It's very interesting that the two things that were being asked to U-turn on, it was winter fuel that was U-turned and not the two-child policy limit, given the politics of how older people vote and the children can't vote.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's the reason. It's older people have noisier voices.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I do think the lack of the lack of a vision of what this government is for is also at the heart of this, in that, like, it would be easier to make difficult changes if Starmer was going out there and saying, okay, this is why we need to make these difficult choices. If we do this, then there are, you know, sunlit uplands, summer ahead. He's not a politician who does that.
Yeah, sorry, John, but this has been a criticism of him for 5 years now. People don't really know what he believes in, and he hasn't got a proper vision. That comes from within the party now. I know MPs, I spend most of my time in Westminster speaking to Labour MPs. That's what Labour MPs are saying to me. But also voters are saying that in the focus groups, right?
It's a huge part of
the job. Himself said it in the Guardian interview, right? He said there is no such thing as Starmerism, I just want to get things done.
Yeah, no, I think he does see himself as a sort of pure managerialist and technocrat, and actually that's not the whole job. Like, you do need to be good at running an administration. Whether he's good at that or not, we'll leave to one side. But you also kind of need to be a salesman. You need to be out there and saying, this is why we are doing the things that we're doing, and this is the part we're expecting you, the public, to play. If he was kind of out there kind of selling that message of solidarity, I think it would be easier for the Labour government to turn around and say, OK, sorry, we are going to have to hike taxes for a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. OK, let's get grading A to F, A, B, C, D, E, F is how they do it. In the NRA, so I'm taking their leadership. We'll do them separately. On the economy, how do we think they've done a year in? Zoe?
I'm going to give them a... Maybe a C.
C? John?
I was going to go C. Now it looks like I'm copying Zoe's homework, but I was going to go C.
I was thinking
like a D plus, actually.
Yeah.
Or a C minus.
I'll also go C, because one of the things we didn't speak about is the some of the public sector pay rises that... we'll talk about that in the NHS, but elsewhere. Welfare, I'm going to give them an F on welfare.
Yeah, welfare. I mean, there's not really much good on welfare to speak of.
I can't think of anything, so yeah.
There was a modest uplift to universal credit in the budget, is that right?
Pretty modest.
Yes. Pretty modest, yeah.
Yeah, okay, we've got C's all round for the economy and F's all around on welfare. Let's move on to the NHS. This is potentially where Labour have the most to speak about in their first year in government. So that's 2 million extra appointments they said they would get within the first year of the Parliament. They actually got that 7 months in, and it's now above 2 million extra appointments that they've been able to unlock. There's bits of criticism on how they've been able to do it, but they have been able to do it. Waiting lists have gone down. There was significant pay rises to junior doctors that stopped a strike that was being planned. Overall, NHS staff in England and Wales have received a 3.6% increase in wages. And NHS England has also been scrapped. We don't quite know the implications of that quite yet. But Wes Streeting, ironically enough, for any potential future leadership elections, probably has the most to shout about now.
I actually think this is probably their strongest area. And it should be, because it's the Labour government.
Yeah.
But
what's also politically beneficial is it always lists in the top three things that people care about.
They pledged £29 billion per year extra for the NHS. As you see, there's been really good progress on waiting lists. They met their pledge of 2 million more GP appointments. They published their 10-year NHS strategy, which has some good, ambitious forward thinking in there. And abolishing NHS England, you know, everyone's given it an um and an R, but I think ultimately people think it is going to be good for reducing bureaucracy.
We might also be on the verge of another strike, by the way, but we'll talk about that.
The failure, of course, is the big elephant in the room, which is social care. They have kicked that into the long grass again with a national care strategy, which is going to come out in a few years' time. We don't really have time to keep pushing this in long grass. We all know it's politically really difficult to deal with.
Again, we know what the solution is. We just don't know how you do it without losing votes.
Yes.
That's always been the problem.
Well, tell us what it is. What's the solution?
You need something not a million miles away from what Gordon Brown's government was proposing 15 years ago, or what Theresa May was looking into 8 years ago, which basically means, like, retirees hit a certain age and put a certain amount of money into a pot. It's like an insurance scheme.
Yeah.
So if you can afford it, the very poorest people would be protected from this. But if you own your own house, you put probably about 10k into a pot, and that funds the social care system. Not everybody is going to need care, but those who do, then there's the money.
But what then would happen? If you propose that, you hemorrhage votes from the most likely to vote
Yeah, so, I mean, they couldn't remove the winter fuel allowance. Mm. How are they going to introduce a five-figure tax on retirees?
I mean, Theresa May lost the 2017 election, I would say, primarily on her pensions pledges. And that she eventually had to U-turn mid. There is this thing, and Zoe speaks about it a lot, by the way, to the point where it sometimes sounds like you hate pensioners, but you don't, right?
Well, no, let's
go
with pensioners.
Let's go now. But our politics is heavily skewed towards older people's priorities.
I think it's sort of structurally inevitable, partly because, I mean, the two things everyone knows about are, like, there are a lot of old people. Like, they're called the baby boomers for a reason. There's a lot of them. And also, they're more likely to vote. But also, they're reasonably widely geographically distributed, whereas younger people, because they need to be near jobs, are much more concentrated in cities and university towns. So even if young people voted at the same rate as older people, they would probably still not have the same level of political power.
Yeah. Okay, so are there more criticisms about the NHS? I would have given a bigger...
I would maybe criticise the lack of a reform vision. Like, I mean, this risks getting technical, but, like, again, everybody knows how you can save money in the NHS, the kind of investments you would need to make, and it probably means having fewer big hospitals but more kind of local clinics and fewer people staying overnight. Everybody knows that. Everybody's known that for a quarter century. You need to invest money up front, and you also need to face down people who complain that you're closing the hospital, and they haven't gone near that.
And I think the other thing is more of a thing to watch is just the government's willingness to engage once again with private finance to kind of... we need resources, we need investment, but it just is one of those things where we also know that sometimes an increase of privatisation drains the resources and weakens standards. So if it's kept an eye on, you can manage it, but people are slightly nervous about Wes Streeting's...
About West Streeting.
It's suspicious of West Streeting. John, give us a scorecard. A to F on the NHS.
I think probably B.
Yeah.
Like, actually, it's not been bad. I mean, my main worry about the health policies is it's been possible because they've chucked so much money at it compared to literally everything else. So, like, the problem is to some extent that it is draining resources that could be saving other bits of the state. But actually, it's not bad in and of itself.
I think that's very fair. Yeah, I would say B.
So I'm going to go C plus, largely because I think... The NHS they took over was literally on its knees and almost over. And I do think it needs a little bit more radicalism. I don't think you can manage an incline on it. I think you've got to be a bit more radical, particularly on social care. But maybe I'll go B as well. I'll go B minus rather than C plus. Like, last one, crime and immigration before we go to a break. So some of the headlines out of this, I hate to put crime and immigration together, but we just have to bunch stuff up because of the lack of time. So they committed to and did scrap the Rwanda immigration policy, which came under heavy scrutiny and criticism as it was rolled out by the Conservatives. There was the reaction to Southport. Really, the first time the Prime Minister was tested in office was the Southport race riots and that spreading across the country. And the Prime Minister has been very, very vocal about being tough on crime, tough on immigration. They constantly tweet and talk about how many people they've deported and removed from the country. That gets quite a lot of pushback from within the Labour Party, but some MPs are also quite happy about it, particularly in Red Wall seats, says it plays well to their more reform-inclined voters. And then the big one that received a huge amount of criticism and he has since U-turned on and said he regrets was the speech where he referred to us maybe becoming an island of strangers. Zoe, how has he done in this?
It's a shame we have to... I understand why we've grouped together. It's a shame we have to, because I would give Law, Order and Justice a very different score from immigration.
So I'm going to take them different scores from
Immigration, I think, pretty terrible, to be honest. Aping reform as much as possible. The Island of Strangers remark just summed it up. You know, not really missing...
What did you think of the... Did you see the Guardian piece where he said...
I felt a bit sorry for him, to be honest. It worked on me, but I'm an empath. I would have been crying next to Rachel Reeves at the dispatch box, to be honest. That's kind of who I am. look, I think you know, you can talk about safer legal routes. I think one good thing Labour has done on immigration is working closer with the EU and admitting you have to do that because global problems require global solutions. But on asylum, I think, you know, okay, fair enough, criminal gangs, let's go for them, but you have to talk about safe and legal routes, and you have to not be afraid of making also a positive case for immigration, especially in our care sector, when we know we have a huge problem. So that's been very, very frustrating. On law and order, I actually think this is where we see most progressive part of this Labour government. If you look at the Gawke Review, which is a shift towards rehabilitation over punishment, ambitious plans to reduce the prison population and tackle reoffending, appointing James Timpson as the prisons minister, I thought was a great
first
move.
That gave a lot of people a lot of hope early on.
I think it did. They've expanded youth services. It's a bit more money for police. I mean, still, it's all stretched. They have inherited a terrible prison system, which is completely overcrowded, and a court system that is bunged
up. Do you know what I think is remarkable about the prison? We never heard about prison crisis, did we? Or did I miss it? We didn't really hear about it in the last sort of 3 years of Conservative government.
There was a couple of times where we heard that prisoners were being put in holding cells. Rather, but then
Labour
flagged up as a looming crisis.
Oh, it was.
But I mean, it is. We have a media that is more likely to give an easy ride to a Conservative government than a Labour one.
Yeah, yeah. And so, because when Shabani Mahmood came in and they said, we got like, we're short 100,000 spaces or something like that.
It was on. Do you remember Sue Gray's shit list? Six looming crises. It was on there.
John, I want to ask you about the Islander Stranger speech, and then I want to talk about Southport, because I think Southport and the Islander Stranger speech are kind of the two starmers, right? Southport, I thought, for certainly, as a Muslim who was, that Friday when I went to Friday prayer, there were three coppers outside our mosque, right? So there was a lot of anxiety, and generally, I feel like the community felt like that was dealt with well, right? Particularly, and then the Island of Stranger speech is the complete opposite. Everybody felt like, you know, I felt like he was calling me a stranger in my own country, right? React to that.
Yeah, no, I entirely agree. I mean, I felt quite emotional the day after Southport when there was that footage of like the local community, just the local Islamic
putting the bricks
community
back,
having come together to rebuild the wall. Yeah, I thought there were positive messages to take there. And it is, again, I think it's the vision thing. Starmer is not one to kind of stand up and say, actually, you know what? The right have been wrong about this.
Yeah.
The line Labour keeps sort of pushing is like Nigel Farage's right vote Labour, and that just feels
wouldn't it? Like I just think there was such an opportunity at that moment with Southport when we did see those images, and it moved me as well, legitimately. For him, I don't know if I wouldn't. I guess it might be accused of being exploitative, but if he'd brought those people in a speech and said, "This is who we are," right? This is who we're not, right? The people who were throwing bricks into mosques and attacking people and attacking hotels. The people who helped to rebuild is who Britain is. That vision could have been so powerful.
It's like they're so worried about losing the votes of largely theoretical and quite possibly dead voters who made effective reform that they don't ever want to stand up and make kind of liberal or left-wing views, arguments for anything.
Yeah, okay, let's give a scorecard because we've got to break. Crime, Zoe.
On law, order, crime, I'm going to give them a B.
John?
Yeah, B minus.
Yeah, I'll be the same. Immigration?
F.
I might go D, because they did at least stop the Rwanda thing, but they not.
Yeah. Okay, maybe I'll do, like, does F plus exist? It feels like something that'd be on the Simpsons.
Can we use a different alphabet? Can we bring in Cyrillic?
D to F is what we'll go with. Okay, well, we've still got a lot to talk about, not least foreign policy, which has been a huge breaking point within the party, and has actually seems to be what Keir Starmer is most keen on, given that he's abroad a lot, and particularly in NATO meetings and others, and probably his best day as Prime Minister may have been his meeting with Donald Trump in the White House. We'll talk about that, and we'll talk about housing, which I know John is particularly passionate about, as is Zoe. We'll do all that after this.
Fubar Radio.
Couple Goals with Sophie Kasai and Jordan Brooke.
When is too early to say I love you? So I've said it the night we met.
Yeah. I did. Right, okay, right, let's just clear this up, right? When I said I love you, I remember I said it in the car.
In the cab, yeah.
In the cab, and I was like, oh my God, I love you.
Yeah, that was the day I made you my girlfriend, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I said I love you, and you were like, I love you too, and I was like, I love you, 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 I love you so much, I love you so much, oh my God, I love you.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
One in five people in the UK are disabled, and it's not always visible. So if we've made ourselves at home in priority spaces on the bus or train, surrounded by our shopping bags or bikes, we could be making it harder for the people who need that space more than us. So let's not forget about the people we share our journeys with, and keep priority spaces clear for others. Remember, it's everyone's journey.
When it comes to heart attacks, you might be surprised to hear the symptoms don't always feel severe. You could experience a squeezing across the chest, a feeling of unease, a sense something's not quite right. Don't be tempted to dismiss the signs and wait to see what happens. The faster you seek medical help, the better your chances. It's never too early to call 999 and describe your symptoms. Your NHS is here for you.
Death, a funny business on FUBAR Radio with Becky Briggs and Natasha Spencer-Levy.
We store so much of our trauma and our energy in our body. I am just incredibly, incredibly tired of keeping this trauma locked inside my body. And so all I needed to do is release it. You know, it's like going on a bender and drinking too much booze and you throw it up because you just need to get that out of your system, because it's gonna catch up with you at some point if you don't.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
We are joined by Miss Safia. If I could produce you a salt, what is he like on paper? Sound like we're on Love Island.
Okay, on paper, my type has to have a good soul, good purpose and calm energy. I'm in my energy era where you've just got to come in and make me happy. I don't need you for anything. I want to find happiness and I need him to be kind.
It's Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald with Politics Uncensored. FUBAR Radio.
You're listening to me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald.
On Politics Uncensored. And in the studio, we've got John Elledge, columnist, New Statesman for The New World, and author, and Zoe's mum's favourite journalist.
I like the way we're foregrounding that. That's important.
This has to go in your Twitter bio.
She's going
to
get
well.
All embarrassed. She's going to go all red.
What's her name? Can I give her a shout?
Sarah.
Sarah, shout
out. Hi, Sarah.
Right, let's talk about foreign policy. Sarah, do text us in if you want to tell us what your views on foreign policy and how you grade the Labour government. So we're going to talk about foreign policy and how Starmer has done. It seems to be his favourite thing to do. I have to say, from the noises I hear from Number 10, and there are a few people I know who were there, they say that he looks most like he's enjoying himself at the sort of foreign summits and things like that. That may be particularly because, in my view, his probably best day in office was his date with Donald Trump in the White House when he presented the letter, largely because everyone thought that that was going to be a shit show. It didn't end up being a shit show, and then Zelensky the following day was a shit show. But he's also had to deal with things like the Ukraine-Russia war and what was pretty heavy support from the Conservatives, particularly Boris Johnson, for Ukraine in that war. He's had to deal with Gaza, where he has received an enormous amount of criticism, in my view, rightly, and actually has lost MPs as a result of that. But also they've had the free trade deals that have come in with India, the United States and Australia and others, as well as strengthening NATO and defence with NATO. How do we want to take this? Do we want to talk about Trump first, Ukraine first, Gaza first, or do we want to take him as a whole?
Let's just talk about his seeming confidence on the world stage.
Yeah, should we start with that? So in that sense, I guess we can talk about NATO and his Trump meeting and others.
I mean, I think a lot of world leaders like being on the world stage.
Yeah.
Like, I think it feels more comfortable. There's less politics. You don't have your party yammering in your ear. You don't have the voters pressing on you. I think voters also tend to be much more kind of aligned across the political spectrum on what they want from their prime minister or president on the world stage. You know, they don't want any wars starting in their country, please. So whatever you have to do to make that happen. And I think for Keir Starmer, he does fit quite nicely with the other kind of technocrats in Europe. So getting closer to Europe, I think, has been fairly easy for him. The obvious challenge has been Donald Trump. But once again, if you look at where the public mood is, yes, there are some people, well, a lot of Brits don't like Donald Trump, but they understand that the UK has to appease him in some way, play a certain role, butter him up in order to avoid his wrath. So I think really it's not that it's an easy job, but I think you can understand why Keir Starmer likes it and why he does quite well at it.
Yeah, John?
I mean, the old cliche is that as prime ministers kind of get into more trouble at home, they start taking more refuge in foreign policy. Starmer came in and was in trouble on day one, so little wonder that he's kind of been...
There is that old saying of the risk is that you don't become your own foreign secretary. When you're in trouble, you have to take stuff more. But sorry, I interrupted.
I think he's brought. At risk of terribly boring radio, I kind of agree with Zoe. I think he's kind of done quite well with Europe, actually, where his thing of like, I'm not going to set out a big vision, I'm just going to tinker with stuff, has actually worked for him, in that he did come back with like an improvement on our previous arrangement with Europe without any fireworks, without any kind of press beforehand. That was good. I think actually not pushing the US further away. I mean, I do have some sympathy with those who are like, who desperately want to see him denounce what is a raging teetering on the edge of fascism at this point. Of course, like, we all want to see him pull away from Trump, but you know, we still need the Americans in the defense of Europe.
Can I ask you about that? Because it seems like we have all accepted on all sides of the political aisle and in the media that we are at the whims of any American president at any given stage, particularly on security, but also now economically post-Europe. Is that something we've just accepted? I'm not saying it's a bad thing, because just the truth,
it's
right?
It's just the reality.
For example, like one of the major generals in the British Armed Forces said, if Russia was to invade us tomorrow, we could withstand it for about 6 months before the army would collapse, right? Largely because the Russian army is so much bigger. NATO accepted the reality?
NATO is incredibly dependent on US military forces. It is possible to kind of imagine a world in which we overcome that. I think there are a lot of conversations going on in Europe, especially between Britain and France, whose militaries have always cooperated quite closely together, even though we don't really talk about it. One of the reasons we are seeing more enthusiasm for increased military spending within Europe is to kind of make it more possible to imagine the continent defending itself without American help again. But as it stands, if the Russians do decide that actually they're going to go into Poland or Lithuania or something, then without American help, we're kind of stuffed.
Yeah.
So like, the reason we can't just kind of tell Donald Trump to go screw himself is because then that is a massive invitation to Vladimir Putin, basically.
Okay. Can we just talk about Gaza as well? Because he has received significant criticism for Gaza, largely because they haven't cut all weapons. They did put a somewhat of an arms embargo of about 300 arms licenses, but they continue to supply F-35 parts, which are massively controversial. There was a huge question about the ICC arrest warrants, which the government eventually said that they would commit to, but they're continue to work with the Israeli government, they say, to kind of withstand them or pull them back, but as part of allies, but that's not really happening. And in the recent Israel-Iran war, when Israel attacked, there was a huge amount of criticism, particularly from the right on Starmer, why he wouldn't explicitly say he supported the American intervention in Iran. The arguments behind the scenes is obviously there were legal advices that it was an illegal strike, which is what Emmanuel Macron said. In 30 seconds, can I get both your sort of reactions on his handling of Gaza?
Yeah, I think this is probably a bit of a stain on Labour's record. Clearly, what is going on in Israel and in Gaza is absolutely objectionable, and the UK has to be very, very careful not to be complicit in that. I think, you know, as you say, in recent months, we have seen some backbone. There's been sanctions on Israeli ministers. They've withdrawn from trade talks. They've reduced some arms exports. It's not enough, but at least there is that direction. And I would say also there is credit due to probably the Attorney General, Richard Hermer, for keeping the UK away from the US Iran strikes. It does feel like they might have learned some lesson from Blair 2003, but you know, it's not enough.
We should caveat this isn't just another conflict the way that it's prescribed, because now the ICC have said there's a plausible case for genocide, which is what the major discussion is. John, very quickly on this.
Yeah, I think the government hasn't done enough to kind of like explain that there is a difference between Israel and the Israeli government and the Israeli and the war it is currently conducting against a defenceless people. And there are obviously political reasons why this Labour Party in particular is very cautious about saying anything that may be construed as anti-Semitism. But nonetheless, once you're at the point of like arguing, well, it's not technically a genocide because then
the argument was it's not a genocide because not enough people have been killed.
It should be absolutely possible for them to stand up and say this is disgusting. This is appalling.
Okay, overall foreign policy, John, what's your grade?
Probably B again, I think.
Yeah, I'm going to give it a C. Give it a C because of Israel, but I think they get good points for Europe dealing with Europe and Trump.
I'm going to give him a D, but that's because I'm very personally invested in Israel and Gaza, as you all know. Last one's housing. I put this in specifically for you, John, but it is a major one. And actually, I think where Keir Starmer's shown the most backbone in going after the some of the NIMBYs in planning reform, in the conversations around grey belts and other things. John, I'm going to give you this first of all. How do you think they've done on housing? They have committed to one of the largest programs of house building, certainly in my lifetime. Planning reform, which is often a big barrier to building more houses, and something Zoe has spoken about very passionately on the show, which is the housing crisis for young people.
No, they have been, I mean, Starmer by his standards has been very, very bold on this one. He has been willing to kind of say, no, here is where the national interest is, and if you oppose it, then I do not speak for you. I think there are some questions over whether they're going to get that close to their 1.5 million new homes target for all sorts of reasons. I think there are ways in which they are still being too cautious, but nonetheless they have they've held the line on the fact that we are going to need to build a lot more. We're going to need to build on land that has not previously been used for housing, and also like one of the nice things recently was the fact that they actually put quite a lot of money into social housing, like far more than the sector was expecting. So there's a lot of I don't think it's enough considering the scale of the crisis, but nonetheless as with the NHS, that's kind of the level of criticism rather than this is a complete
fuck-up. You say that. Do you want to know the irony I think of this is? Of all the areas that we've spoken about, the two people being tipped to be the next leader of the Labour Party are where we've spoken about being the best areas. Angela Rayner has the brief of housing and Wes Streeting has the brief of health. So something to think about. Zoe, how's it?
Yeah, I think John's spot on, really. The other thing I would add is they do earn some marks from me for pushing forward the renters reform protections because that got kicked into the long grass so many times by the Tories, who the Conservative Party, for those who don't know, is full of landlords. And there are some in the Labour Party as well, don't get me wrong. But it's good that we're finally going to have a ban on no-fault evictions. There is probably more they should do with the rental market, because the precarity of renters is a huge issue in this country. But banning no-fault evictions is big because, you know, the fact that it is legal to kick someone out for no reason, just give them, what is it, 1 or 2 months? 2 months notice has a massive impact on people's lives. I think planning reform stuff is really good, really important to key to unlocking investment in this country and getting the country moving again. But again, it's just slow and there are still questions to answer about whether the legal system is fit to deal with the planning reforms, you know, whether there are enough planning officers to deal with the pace of planning reform. There's all these questions, I think, that still need answering. But I think basically the fuck the NIMBYs stuff is good and overdue and a welcome break from the Tories, who basically had a lot of NIMBYs that they had to placate all the time.
And I mean, Labour has some, but it's far, far less than I think the Tories have, and actually far less probably than the Greens do.
Less. The Greens are awful on this.
This is, by the way, this can probably be a line in the sand that Labour can fight the Greens on and welcome that fight, probably, no?
They could. I mean, I think the slight risk there is one of the reasons so many politicians support NIMBY campaigns is because NIMBYism is popular. It's massively damaging. But nonetheless, there is, a lot of people don't understand the more theoretical arguments, or they don't see how, like, the construction at the end of their street, which is causing traffic jams, is necessary for other people who do not currently have homes. So I don't necessarily think that would be a vote winner against the Greens. But nonetheless, it's worth restating the Greens are completely shockingly useless on this. Worse than the Tories, I would say.
John, give us Labour's grade on housing.
B plus.
B plus, I agree, yeah?
Yeah, B plus.
Okay, so we've given them, broadly, It's a tale of two cities, or a tale of two Starmers. We've been quite critical of them, particularly on welfare. I've been quite critical on foreign policy, but we've all been on crime and immigration specifically, but praised them on housing and NHS. And I guess given them a we'll wait and see on the economy. But there is a lot of discussions about whether Starmer's going to survive the next year. It's being openly spoken about in the Labour Party. It's being openly spoken about in the media. The things that are being said is if the local elections in 2026 go as badly as people think it's going to go, then he might be, you know, out on his ear. Rachel Reeves' job is in question, as well as others, including people like David Lammy. If you were to look at it overall, what grade would you give the Labour Party overall and why? Or the Labour government overall and why?
D. John?
D, yeah.
Like it's not a complete disaster. There are green shoots, as they say.
Yeah.
And like one of the interesting lines in that Starmer interview from the weekend was like, well, I do at least learn from my mistakes. And I think there is some evidence of that. Mm-hmm. So I think it is possible his second year will go better than his first. But there are a lot of mistakes to learn from. Mm.
I also agree in D. But one of the things, one of the lessons they haven't learned from, because I keep frustrating because we keep talking about it, is the vision. Mm-hmm. If they don't come up with a story for this government, doesn't matter how much good you do, is, you know, it's that old, we say it in political comms, if you can't tell your story, what you've done doesn't really matter, because if you can't bring people with you, it'll eventually fall apart. So I think I was actually quite worried when I saw Starmer's there is no Starmerism in that Guardian interview, because if he doesn't pull that together, then I think it'll be particularly dangerous. But we've all been agreed on a D, and we'll see what the next year holds. And if by the time we do this next year, which, John, I really hope you come back and join us for year two as we look back on year two, will the Prime Minister be Keir Starmer at that moment? Thank you so much for joining us. You can join us again next week at Thursday at 5 p.m. for another episode of Politics Uncensored. You can follow the show at Politics Uncensored UK, where you can find me at Ali Milani UK.
And me at Zoe Greenefold.
John, where can people find you?
Just Google John Elledge. I'm in Escape. I'm about 80% of the internet at this point.
Yes, Google John Elledge. You can find him on New Statesman, New World. I read his book. He's a best-selling author. Sarah, shout out to you again. Thank you so much for listening. Join us next week on another episode of Politics Uncensored.
FUPAR Radio.